The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the September 3rd, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a now familiar scene at the Kabul airport in Afghanistan. The foreground, there's thousands of Afghans outside. You see the concrete wall with razor wire on top. One Afghan's trying to climb it. There are two American soldiers standing on top of the wall. In the background, you can see one of the airlift planes going off in the distance. And one of the Afghanis is lifting up a baby, and the one of the American soldiers is reaching over to lift him to safety. The headline is Running Out of Time. As withdrawal deadline looms, the U.S. mounts frantic effort to get Americans and allies out. And no surprise, we will hear a lot about that this week, starting with our first main story. A race against the clock in Kabul. What happened? President Biden held firm this week to a complete U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan by August 31st, adding urgency to the race to evacuate thousands of Americans and key Afghan allies. Biden said the administration is on pace to finish on time, with airlifts accelerating to more than 82,000 people evacuated since Kabul fell on August 14th. He cited an acute and growing risk of an attack on the airport and departing planes by the Islamic State's local affiliate, as well as the Taliban's warning of consequences for not meeting the deadline. Each day of our operations brings added risk to our troops, he said. Biden left the door open to delaying the final departure, saying he'd ask military leaders to develop contingency plans should that become necessary. U.S. officials say they were trying to locate an unknown number of U.S. citizens in Afghanistan, and helicopters were sent into Kabul to pluck some of them out and bring them to the airport. Some European leaders and U.S. lawmakers had beseeched Biden to extend the deadline. Biden will have blood on his hands, said Representative Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas. People are going to die, and they are going to be left behind. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said the militant group was allowing foreign nationals to leave, but is now blocking Afghans from entering the Kabul airport. Skilled professionals should remain in Afghanistan and work in their own specialist areas, he said. He also said women should stay off the street for their own safety, calling it a temporary measure until Taliban fighters are trained to respect them. The airport was a scene of chaos and desperation as thousands of Afghans, frantic to escape the Taliban, huddled outside a perimeter of walls and barbed wire. At least seven Afghans, including a two-year-old, were killed in a weekend stampede. With no sanitation or power amid blistering heat, reports grew of squalid conditions and mounting misery. The scenes are apocalyptic, said PBS correspondent Jane Ferguson. People are fainting and dying. Children are going missing. What the editorial said. Biden is shamefully bowing to Taliban demands, said the Wall Street Journal. With NATO help, he could have provided enough military muscle to retrieve stranded Americans and Afghan allies past the deadline, thus salvaging some of our squandered honor and credibility. Instead, he's negotiated from a position of weakness. And as a result, we're abandoning thousands of Afghan allies to the Taliban's brand of retribution. Thanks to the courage and ingenuity of the U.S. and other military personnel on the ground, there's been huge progress on the enormous evacuation task, said the Washington Post. Still, untold numbers of Americans remain in Afghanistan, not to mention legions of vulnerable Afghans whose prospects now seem grim indeed. If we can't extract them by the deadline, Biden must either bargain for more time or keep our troops on the ground regardless of what the Taliban want. What the columnist said. America may now be in the middle of the largest hostage crisis in its history, said Noah Rothman in commentary.org. It's clear to everyone but the Biden White House that we're not going to get everyone out and that the Taliban hold all the cards. CIA Chief William Burns even went to Kabul to negotiate with Taliban leader Abdul Ghani Baradar, perhaps in a failed attempt to bribe the Taliban with frozen Afghan government funds to extend the deadline. Our humiliation in Afghanistan is only just beginning. Some perspective is in order, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. The pool of at-risk Afghans who want to escape is virtually limitless. The International Rescue Committee put it at 300,000. No one ever envisioned airlifting hundreds of thousands of people after the Afghan government collapsed. Right now, the Biden administration is moving heaven and earth to extract tens of thousands of them. That's hardly abandoning our allies. The scene unfolding in Afghanistan was always inevitable, said Lance Kuntz in the Kansas City Star. As a U.S. Marine captain who did two tours there, I saw that the U.S.-funded Afghan army amounted to a jobs program for Afghans, many of whom served only on paper, with a lot of our tax dollars being siphoned off by corrupt elites. Despite the 20 years of lies told by politicians and generals, Afghanistan was never a functioning nation. In hindsight, it's easy to say we should have gotten more Afghans out sooner, said David Leonard in the New York Times. But in June, then-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani asked Biden not to grant tens of thousands of exit visas because it would signal the U.S. had no faith in his government. Yes, the evacuation could have gone better than it has, but a huge quiet evacuation program is a contradiction in terms. Controversy of the week. Afghanistan. Will Biden suffer lasting political damage? Up to now, President Biden has been impervious to Republican attacks, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com, but he just shredded his own credibility. Biden's botched withdrawal from Afghanistan has filled American TV screens with unforgettable and horrifying images, and his defense of the fiasco has been riddled with half-truths and blatant deceptions. On July 8th, the president insisted that the Taliban could not defeat the Afghan army and that the departure of U.S. troops would not prompt scenes like the fall of Saigon. There's going to be no circumstance where you see people lifted off the roof of an embassy, Biden told Americans. Now that his wishful thinking has been proved wrong, he's claimed in a series of defensive speeches that his administration had plans to respond to every contingency. What malarkey. Americans were promised that Biden would return adults-in-the-room judgment to the White House, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. But even many Democrats are openly questioning how the withdrawal has been handled, while gleeful Republicans are seizing on the opening to portray Biden as a senile second coming of Jimmy Carter. Biden's mishandling of the withdrawal is a scandal, but the bigger one is the war that he is ending, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. The 20-year-old Afghanistan conflict cost more than $2 trillion and the lives of an estimated 241,000 Americans, Afghans, and U.S. allies, all to have the Taliban ultimately regain control. Many of the pillars of the political and media establishment, now excoriating Biden, have every incentive to divert our attention from their role in cheerleading us into a nation-building boondoggle. And if Biden had heeded his military advisor's call to keep 2,500 soldiers there, the enraged Taliban would have considered it a breach of its 2020 treaty with Trump administration and launched a major offensive, forcing Biden to send more troops back in. The crisis has cost Biden public support for now, said Harry Enten in CNN.com. Though 62% of respondents to an Associated Press poll still said the Afghanistan war had not been worth fighting, Biden's handling of the withdrawal dropped his average public approval ratings below 50% for the first time. Still, the American public often has a short memory about foreign policy misadventures, and in a year, voters may ultimately not care. What a sad indictment of the country that would be, said Noah Rothman in commentary.org. It would mean Americans have grown so hopelessly jaded and callous that they're indifferent to the fate of Afghan civilians, the thousands of allies we will leave behind, the terror threats that could bloom in a Taliban-controlled country, and the waning of America's global influence. The Biden White House is betting that America is finished at the global superpower and that you will welcome our decline. Biden's popularity will continue to sag if his decision-making remains rooted in conflict avoidance, said Perry Bacon Jr. in the Washington Post. Many of his administration's missteps, such as his initial hesitance to accept more than a token number of Afghan refugees or to impose vaccine mandates, suggest an aversion to triggering culture war issues. Biden prefers to project an image of competence and smiley-faced bipartisanship. But with Republicans committed to obstruction, partisan and cultural conflicts are inevitable. And on most issues, including mask and vaccination mandates, Biden has popular opinion behind him. For the good of the country and his presidency, Biden should drop the pretense that bipartisan agreement is possible and fight on more polarized issues instead of trying to dodge them. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for steals of the week, with bids starting at $2 million for the Los Angeles Cemetery Crypt directly adjacent to Hugh Hefner's and Marilyn Monroe's. The seller of the empty family crypt says the price goes back to the adage, location, location, location. It was a good week for hope over experience, with news that giant container ship Ever Given made it through the Suez Canal carefully for the first time since it disrupted global trade by getting stuck there in March. And it was a good week for the ascent of man. After a meta-analysis of previous surveys found that a majority of Americans, 54%, finally agree with the statement that human beings, as we know them today, developed from earlier species of animals. Just a decade ago, only 40% believed in evolution. But it was a bad week for paradise. After Governor David Icke of Hawaii advised tourists not to come to the state until after its current tourist-fueled coronavirus surge subsides. Hawaii's hospitals are nearly full, Icke warned, adding, It's not a good time to travel to the islands. It was a bad week for Donald Trump, who was surprised by boos and jeering from a rally crowd in COVID-ravaged Alabama when he advised them to take the vaccines. Trump then retreated to, "You got your freedoms." Finally, it was a bad week for Joey Chestnut, the competitive eating superstar, with a new study suggesting that every hot dog a person eats shortens their life by 36 minutes. By this math, Chestnut, 37, who has consumed an estimated 19,200 hot dogs over the past 16 years, has already shaved 1.3 years from his time on Earth. And a short and other news piece while we're here. Democrats unite behind $3.5 trillion budget. The House voted on party lines to approve a roughly $3.5 trillion budget resolution this week after Speaker Nancy Pelosi quashed a revolt among moderate Democrats. The House budget will enable Senate Democrats to pass a budget through reconciliation, avoiding a potential Republican filibuster. President Biden has pushed for $3.5 trillion to fund universal preschool, paid family leave, child and elder care, a Medicare expansion, and broad climate initiatives, paid for through tax increases on high earners and corporations. Nine House Democrats threatened to oppose the measure, demanding to vote first on the $1 trillion infrastructure bill passed by the Senate last month. They relented after Pelosi promised to vote on that bill by September 27th. On the briefing page this week, the new Taliban government. The Islamist militant group once again controls Afghanistan. Have the Taliban changed in their 20 years out of power? Who are the new leaders? Afghanistan's new ruler will likely be Abdul Ghani Baradar, a close friend of the late Taliban founder Muhammad Omar. Baradar was one of the Mujahideen who fought against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the 1980s, and when the Taliban ruled from 1996 to 2001, he was a repressive governor of several provinces. Like former President Hamid Karzai, he is of the Pashtun Durrani tribe. Baradar has been negotiating with Karzai when he was arrested by U.S. and Pakistani agents in 2010 and jailed in Pakistan. The Trump administration had him freed in 2018, part of an eventual mass prisoner release of 5,000 Taliban militants that changed the course of the war, so he could participate in peace negotiations in Doha, Qatar. A prominent deputy of Sirajuddin Haqqani, leader of the Haqqani Network, which the U.S. has designated a terrorist group. Both he and Baradar have been working toward the Taliban restoration for 20 years. When the Taliban were routed after the U.S. invasion in 2001, they adopted a motto: "You have the watches, we have the time." How did they return to power? Through a combination of corruption and misrule of the Afghan government and a U.S. peace deal that undercut the government's legitimacy. The deal, which then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the Trump administration negotiated in Doha in early 2020 without any Afghan government participation, committed the U.S. to withdrawing remaining troops by May 1st, 2021, and halted the punishing airstrikes that had kept the Taliban contained. At that point, the Taliban laid the groundwork for a quick takeover by bribing regional governors and threatening Afghan army soldiers who had been unpaid for months. The Afghan army was created in the image of the U.S. Army to rely on heavy equipment and air power. Once the U.S. vacated Bagram Air Base in early July, the Afghans were left largely helpless and unwilling to fight for a corrupt government that often could not supply or pay its troops. In the last days, soldier Taj Mohammed told the Wall Street Journal, there was no food, no water, and no weapons. How will the Taliban rule? The Taliban follow an extreme form of Sharia law that metes out eye for an eye justice, including cutting off the hands of thieves and public stonings. Under their rule last time, women were forbidden to work or to go to school, had to wear head-to-toe burqas, and were beaten for any perceived infraction of modesty. Men were beaten or killed for listening to Western music, for shaving or trimming their beards, or for following Shiite Islam instead of the Taliban strain of Sunnism. Analysts say there is little indication that the group has become more moderate. Rural areas under Taliban control in recent years were largely run along these lines, although some local elders were able to negotiate compromises to keep girls' schools open. One glimmer of hope is that the Taliban may be forced to compromise even more as they try to govern urban areas in a country that has changed immensely since 2001. How has Afghanistan changed? More than 3 out of 4 Afghans are under age 25 and have no memory of life under the Taliban. Afghan cities are modern metropolises with educated workforces, thanks partly to U.S. investment of more than $144 billion in Afghan reconstruction, more in inflation-adjusted dollars than the U.S. spent on Europe after World War II. These urbanites will not easily submit to medieval rules and repression. Still, more than half of Afghans live in rural areas and get by on subsistence agriculture. Tribal ties are key, and that is what the Taliban intend to exploit with a theocratic government that controls provinces through shura, or tribal councils. With years of experience in negotiations, the Taliban leadership is savvy enough to claim that its government will be multi-ethnic and respect women's rights within Sharia. On the ground, though, Taliban fighters have already begun executing enemies and forcing girls into marriage, and terrified women have gone into hiding, burning their diplomas. What about the international community? The Taliban are eager to avoid the pariah state status that hobbled their relations last go-round. They have long had the tacit support of Pakistan, and now it is overt. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan praised their victory, saying that they had broken Afghanistan's shackles of slavery. China and Russia, too, have expressed satisfaction at the defeat of the U.S. Both have kept their embassies in Kabul open, in a sign that they see trade and security opportunities in Taliban-run Afghanistan, although both are wary of Islamic extremism spilling over into their own territories. The West, meanwhile, will likely feel compelled to continue aid to the Afghan people, even if it doesn't recognize the Taliban. There is a drought, there is a pandemic, said the former U.S. Deputy Mission Chief Annie Fortzheimer. All we can expect is to go from one crisis to another. a few of the best columns of the week. Start with yet another troubled school year. The pandemic has already begun to wreak havoc on a third school year, said Sarah Zong. Parents once had reason to hope that the 2021-22 year might be a return to normal. Evidence from last semester suggested that schools could indeed stay open with proper precautions, and the arrival of vaccines theoretically meant children wouldn't pass the virus on to vulnerable adults at home. But the Delta variant surge, a culture war over masks and vaccination, and the back-to-school season have converged in the worst possible way. That means more confusion and hardship for parents and kids. Nine states now ban local mask mandates, and with kids under 12 not yet eligible for vaccination and community transmission high, many elementary school kids inevitably will test positive. Some will get sick. After only 1 week of classes, 8,400 students in one Florida school district had to be quarantined. And the virus' unchecked spread has forced districts in Mississippi and Alabama back into remote learning. Communities with high vaccination rates and a layered set of mitigation strategies, including masking, ventilation, and widespread testing, are best positioned to have in-person classes. Those without are heading into another very rocky school year. The real tragedy of Haiti. The world has long defined Haiti by its tragedies, such as its current political turmoil and the recent earthquake that killed more than 2,200 people, said Peniel Joseph. But the island country also has a rich history as a trailblazer in black liberation and independence. In 1806, Haiti became the New World's first black republic. After Toussaint Louverture led the only successful slave revolt in modern history, Haiti paid dearly for its success, which alarmed slaveholding nations throughout the world. France used warships to extort Haiti into taking on a crippling debt for the supposed lost value of its slaves. U.S. leaders exploited Haiti economically for decades, then invaded the country in 1915. Foreign interventions and unjust debt severely hindered the newly independent country's ability to prosper and foster its own political fortunes. The U.S. repeatedly meddled in Haiti's politics to prevent socialists from taking power, helping to install strongman leaders such as Papadoc Duvalier and his son Jean-Claude, a.k.a. Baby Doc. Corruption, chaos, and oppression followed. Haiti is not irreparably broken, but it's time for the U.S. and the international community to finally empower the people of Haiti to shape their own destiny. This column comes from Canada. Hold firm against China's hostage taking. China is conducting hostage diplomacy, said Brian Lilly. Canadian businessman Michael Spavor was sentenced earlier this month to 11 years in prison after being convicted by a Chinese court on a trumped-up charge of espionage. He was arrested in December 2018, around the same time as another Canadian, former diplomat Michael Kovrig, whose case is still pending. And Spavor's sentencing took place a day after a third Canadian, Robert Schellenberg, lost his appeal against a death sentence for drug trafficking. All these men are being used by Beijing to pressure Canada into releasing Meng Wanzhou, a top executive at Huawei and daughter of the tech giant's founder, who was arrested in Vancouver in 2018 on a U.S. extradition warrant for fraud. In short, China is willing to kill a Canadian and deny others their freedom to stop one of their own from facing a proper court system. So far, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has wisely resisted taking the easy route of a hostage swap. He knows that if he were to trade Ming, no Canadian would ever be safe in China again. But he faces immense pressure. To find a solution that doesn't involve capitulating, he will have to harness the support of our allies, particularly the U.S., whose warrant we are enforcing. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Terror, Anguish, and Regret. Three views of the Afghanistan war from a reporter covering the chaos, an Afghan woman fearful of losing her freedom, and a U.S. Marine who directed drone and fighter strikes on the Taliban. Afghan allies losing hope of escaping. David Zucchino. Last week, a former interpreter for a U.S. company in Kabul plunged into a mass of humanity outside a gate at the Kabul airport with her family in tow. Even as she was jostled and elbowed by people in the throng, she pushed ahead, desperate to secure a flight out of the country for everyone accompanying her. Her husband, 2-year-old daughter, disabled parents, 3 sisters, and a cousin. Then the crowd surged. The entire family was slammed to the ground. People trampled them where they lay, the woman recalled just hours later. She remembered someone smashing her cell phone and someone else kicking her in the head. She could not breathe, so she tried to tear off her abaya, a robe-like dress. As she struggled to her feet, she said, she searched for her toddler. The girl was dead, trampled to death by the mob. I felt pure terror, the woman said in a telephone interview from Kabul. I couldn't save her. In the days since the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan, Afghans have negotiated a terrifying new reality after enduring 20 years of war and suicide bombings. Across the country, Afghans who served the U.S. military effort in Afghanistan or the U.S.-backed former government are in hiding, many of them threatened with death by the Taliban. A 39-year-old former interpreter for the U.S. military and Western aid groups was hiding Saturday inside a home in Kabul with his wife and 2 children. He said the Taliban had telephoned, telling him, "Face the consequences. We will kill you." The interpreter said he had given up trying to secure a flight after a harrowing and ultimately futile attempt to force his way past Taliban gunmen and unruly mobs at the airport the day before. He has been spending his time calling and texting American soldiers and officers in the United States who are struggling to find ways to rescue him and his family. "I'm losing hope," he said by telephone. "I think maybe I will have to accept the consequences." In the Shahr-e-Nah neighborhood of Kabul, a female Afghan journalist said she finally ventured outside her hiding indoors since last Sunday. Trying to obey randomly enforced Taliban strictures on women, she wore a full-body abaya. "It was so heavy, it made me feel sick," she said. And in the street, she said, "There is no music, nothing. All you hear is the Taliban talking on TVs and radio." She said her sister-in-law appeared in front of male family members with her hair uncovered. Her brother-in-law gave her a vicious kick and told her, "Put your bloody scarf on." In the eastern province of coast, a male journalist was also in hiding, moving between his home and the home of a family member. Taliban fighters were roaring through the province in U.S.-supplied vehicles captured from Afghan security forces, he said. He feared they would find him soon. I'm out of hope, he said. Pray for me. In Kabul, the woman whose daughter was killed said the family was able to bring the girl's body back for burial. She wept as she recalled how she would try to ease her daughter's fears whenever gunshots rang out in the neighborhood. She had told her they were crackers, firecrackers. My baby was such a brave child, she said. When she heard the gunshots, she would yell out, crackers. Inside the Kabul house where the former interpreter was hiding, hope was fading. He said he was gratified by persistent attempts at assistance by the American soldiers he had once served, but had concluded they could do nothing. If the Taliban kill me, okay, I can accept that, he said. I only ask them to spare my children. Burning my diploma so the Taliban don't find it. An Afghan resident. I was heading to university for a class when a group of women came running out from the women's dormitory. I asked what had happened, and one of them told me the police were evacuating them because the Taliban had arrived in Kabul, and they will beat women who do not have a burqa. We all wanted to get home, but we couldn't use public transport. The drivers would not let us in their cars because they did not want to take responsibility for transporting a woman. It was even worse for the women from the dormitory, who were from outside Kabul and were scared and confused about where they should go. Meanwhile, the men standing around were making fun of girls and women, laughing at our terror. Go and put on your chadari, burqa, one called out. It is your last days of being out in the street, said another. I will marry four of you in one day, said a third. With the government offices closed down, my sister ran for miles across town to get home. I shut down the PC that helped to serve my people and community for 4 years with a lot of pain, she said. I left my desk with tearful eyes and said goodbye to my colleagues. I knew it was the last day of my job. I have nearly completed two simultaneous degrees from two of the best universities in Afghanistan. I should have graduated in November from the American University of Afghanistan and Kabul University, but this morning everything flashed before my eyes. I worked for so many days and nights to become the person I am today. And this morning when I reached home, the very first thing my sisters and I did was hide our IDs, diplomas, and certificates. It was devastating. Why should we hide the things that we should be proud of? In Afghanistan now, we are not allowed to be known as the people we are. As a woman, I feel like I am the victim of this political war that men started. I felt like I can no longer laugh out loud. I can no longer listen to my favorite songs. I can no longer meet my friends in our favorite cafe. I can no longer wear my favorite yellow dress or pink lipstick. And I can no longer go to my job or finish my university degree that I worked for years to achieve. I loved doing my nails. Today, as I was on my way home, I glanced at the beauty salon where I used to go for manicures. The shop front, which had been decorated with beautiful pictures of girls, had been whitewashed overnight. All I could see around me were the fearful and scared faces of women and ugly faces of men who hate women, who do not like women to get educated, work, and have freedom. Most devastating to me were the ones who looked happy and made fun of women. Instead of standing by our side, they stand with the Taliban and give them even more power. Now it looks like I'll have to burn everything I achieved in 24 years of my life. During the last months, as the Taliban took control in the provinces, hundreds of people fled their houses and came to Kabul to save their girls and wives. I was a part of a group of American university students that tried to help them by collecting donations of cash, food, and other necessities and distributing it to them. I could not stop my tears when I heard the stories of some families. One had lost their son in the war and didn't have any money to pay the taxi fare to Kabul. So they gave their daughter-in-law away in exchange for transportation. How can the value of a woman be equal to the cost of a journey? Then today, when I heard that the Taliban had reached Kabul, I felt I was going to be a slave. They can play with my life any way they want. Killing hundreds without leaving my base. Ian Cameron. For 9 months in 2018 and 2019, roughly the 18th year of America's war in Afghanistan, I directed airstrikes against the Taliban. From an operation center made mostly of plywood in the middle of Helmand Desert in southern Afghanistan, our team of intelligence, artillery, and aviation specialists deployed some of the world's most sophisticated technology against Taliban fighters who were primarily armed with rifles designed during World War II. We tracked and hunted these militants for hours every day with multi-million-dollar indefatigable Reaper and Predator drones. We guided A-10 Warthogs, F-18 fighter jets, or Apache helicopters to these targets, and the drones' high-powered cameras provided intimate portraits of the effect of well-aimed steel and explosives on human flesh. I oversaw these airstrikes every day in a neat 8-hour shift, pretty much the only regular schedule I ever had in the Marines. I'd wake up in my can, a small but comfortable air-conditioned metal container outfitted with a bed, a desk, and a dresser. I would take a hot shower and shave and then walk 100 feet over to the cafeteria for a breakfast of eggs, bacon, and Cheerios. Afterward, I crossed a small dusty road lined with porta-johns to arrive at the operations center. I brewed a pot of coffee and then took over my shift at 8 a.m. I killed men for the next 8 hours. In 9 months, I directed more than 250 airstrikes, resulting in 304 Taliban members killed and 54 wounded. At 4 p.m., my replacement, a fellow Marine captain, would arrive. Once we completed our turnover checklist, I left the operations center and returned to my can. I changed into exercise clothes, hit the gym, and took another hot shower. At dinner, Indian cook served up country fried steak or an overcooked salmon fillet with an iceberg lettuce salad, and I ate in front of a large screen television. I joined the military out of my general desire to serve my country in uniform and my parents' very specific desire to put 4 kids through college on a tight budget. I chose the Naval Academy over West Point largely because the images of Army soldiers getting blown up by IEDs scared me. But once in Annapolis, I was struck by the professionalism and sense of purpose exuded by the Marines I met. I felt compelled to join their ranks, and I devoted myself to preparing for that goal. I studied the Arabic language and Middle Eastern history, society, and politics. I devoured combat literature. Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, Carl Marlantes' Matterhorn, Nathaniel Fick's One Bullet Away, all with one consuming question. When the time came and I looked my enemy in the eye, would I have what it takes? This was not the kind of mission I had spent my adult life preparing for. In this campaign, there would be no boots on the ground, at least not American boots. Instead, we'd be working with those non-too-aggressive Afghan army and police forces, supporting them by conducting remote targeting from the air-conditioned safety of our base. Usually after I had directed a strike, a reconnaissance drone confirmed it was a clean strike, meaning no civilian casualties. Then the tension in the control room dissipated. But I remember feeling very differently after the strikes that did not go as smoothly, the tragic handful when we killed or maimed bystanders. I remember the dread of watching the wrong motorcycle drive into the impact zone of our bombs. I remember the gradual tightening in my stomach as a post-strike review revealed that one of the bodies on the screen was too small to be an adult. It was in these instances that the video game stopped and the flesh and blood consequences of what we were doing hit me. A wave of sickness, regret, second guessing. Yet my routine on the base would remain largely unchanged. I'd work out, grab a hot shower, and listen to the Marines in the cafeteria debate the merits of competing bachelor candidates over chocolate ice cream. I'd go back to my can and call my girlfriend. With a hollow feeling in my stomach, I'd stare at the aluminum roof and drift off to sleep. Versions of these stories were originally published in the New York Times, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The singer who soared in brotherly harmony, Don Everly, 1937 to 2021. Don Everly drew acclaim for his songwriting and driving rhythm guitar style, but it was the magic that occurred when his voice intertwined with that of his brother, Phil, that brought him enduring fame. As the Everly brothers, the pair were among the most prolific hit makers of the early rock and roll era, issuing a stream of singles that blended country, pop, and rhythm and blues, built on the brothers' soaring Appalachian-tinged harmonies. Between 1957 and 1962, they had 15 top 10 hits, including Bye Bye Love, Wake Up Little Susie, All I Have to Do Is Dream, and the Don penned Kathy's Clown. The Beatles cited the siblings as a crucial influence, as did Simon and Garfunkel and scores of other artists. When Phil and I hit that one spot where I call it the Everly Brothers, Don said in 1986, I don't know where it is because it's not me and it's not him. It's the two of us together. Born in Brownie, Kentucky, Don and his younger brother grew up immersed in country music, said the Nashville Tennessean. Their guitarist father, Ike, was a miner who quit the coal fields to pursue music, moving the family to Chicago, then Shenandoah, Iowa, where he hosted a radio show with his singer wife, Margaret. The sons hit the airwaves before they were out of elementary school, billed as Little Donnie and Baby Boy Phil. The family made their way to Nashville, where Don had success as a songwriter while he was still a teen. The Everlys were rejected by nearly every label in town before landing a deal with the New York label Cadence in 1957, said the Chicago Tribune. It yielded an immediate and huge payoff when their first single, Bye Bye Love, hit number one. By the mid-60s, their star was waning, said the Times UK. Don struggled with drug addiction, attempted suicide, and was treated with electroshock therapy. Offstage, the brothers had a notoriously inharmonious relationship that hit its nadir when Phil stormed offstage in 1973, leaving Don to tell the audience they were finished. Each tried a solo career without significant success. In 1983, they reunited for a concert in London's Royal Albert Hall, which was followed by a trio of well-received albums. They took to the road occasionally, though by the time Phil died in 2014, the Everlys hadn't performed as a duo in nearly a decade. "Everything is different about us," Don said, "except when we sing together." Here's an article from the Health and Science page. Shattering myths about metabolism. Bad news for people who blame their middle age spread on a waning metabolism. A new study has found that metabolic rates actually remain rock solid through most of our adult lives. The research involved more than 6,400 people, ranging in age from 8 days to 95 years old, in 29 countries. The participants were given water containing isotopes that could be traced in urine samples. By analyzing these samples, scientists could calculate exactly how much carbon dioxide each person was producing, a precise measure of how many calories they were burning. The researchers found that after peaking around your first birthday, your metabolism declines by about 3% a year until around age 20. Then it plateaus until you hit 60, when it starts to decline again, but only by about 1% a year. The team's finding also upended other long-held assumptions about metabolism, that it wanes more in women than in men, that it spikes during teenage years and pregnancy, and that it is slowed by menopause. People will say, "Well, when I hit 30 years old, my metabolism fell apart," lead author Herman Pontzer from Duke University tells NBCNews.com. "We don't see any evidence for that, actually." Researchers say if weight gain in middle age has nothing to do with metabolism, it is most likely the result of changes to lifestyle factors such as diet, activity level, and sleep. A step closer to nuclear fusion. Researchers have made a major breakthrough in the quest to achieve nuclear fusion, the process that powers the sun and a potential source of almost unlimited clean energy here on Earth. Unlike fission, the reaction used in existing nuclear power plants, fusion involves the joining rather than the splitting of atoms and so leaves behind no radioactive waste. Kickstarting that process requires ignition, the tipping point at which fusion begins to release more energy than is required to detonate it. In an attempt to reach the holy grail of ignition, researchers at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California focused 192 gigantic lasers onto a 5-millimeter-wide capsule of hydrogen fuel. This produced a hot spot the diameter of a human hair, causing hydrogen atoms in the fuel to fuse into helium and igniting a burst of more than 10 quadrillion watts of fusion power for 100 trillionths of a second. Crucially, the reactions appeared to be self-sustaining. The process released only two-thirds of the energy delivered by the lasers, but scientists think energy output can eventually exceed input. This is truly an amazing feat. Carolyn Kranz, a plasma physicist at the University of Michigan, who was not involved in the study, tells Science News, "It makes me very hopeful for fusion in the future." And we've just time for some short notes left. Let's see. The Food and Drug Administration is urging people not to take the drug ivermectin, which is used to treat worms in horses and goats and cows to prevent or treat COVID, after scores of people were sickened and or hospitalized. Ivermectin, which can cause vomiting, seizures, and in high doses death, is being touted as a COVID cure by anti-vaxxers. "You are not a horse," the FDA said. "You are not a cow. Seriously, y'all, stop it." The drought gripping 47% of the land area of the contiguous 48 states, almost all of it in the West and High Plains states, is likely to continue into the fall, government forecasters warned last week. In California, half the state is in the most severe drought category, and farmers have sharp cuts in water allotments. An estimated 30,100 soldiers and veterans died by suicide while or after serving in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other fronts of the war on terror since 2001, according to Brown University's Cost of War Project. That's more than four times the number who died in combat. 75 journalists and media workers were killed in Afghanistan between 2001 and 2021. During the war, 444 humanitarian aid workers were killed. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from poet Rainer Maria Rilke, quoted in the New York Times, who says, "Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.